My name is Ralph White, and I'm an alcoholic. I wanted to test that and see if we got a voice coming out tonight. I'm dizzy. It's not the first time I've been dizzy on Friday night, but kind of dizzy. Thank you, Johnny. Thank you, Dick. You know, I can't believe it when Johnny said this is the 11th one. I feel humbled. The first one of these deals Dick and Barbara did, there was Clancy, there was Sandy Beach, there was Tom Ivester, there was my sponsor, Bob Bazant. It's like, oh my God. And if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous and you don't recognize the names, and that's all right, they're drunks. Pretty much they're drunks. And we don't put people on pedestals and we don't idolize, but as a kid, I wanted to wear number 30 and play shortstop for the Dodgers because Maury Wills was my idol. A little bit later on, Lakers on my team, I could tell you everything Magic Johnson was doing and everything. So there are people who make an impact on me. There are people who leave footprints in my life. And some of them get to stay with us, and every now and then I like to remember. You know, and I know originally Dick talked about hoping that Clancy could be in this spot. You know, I was at home some years ago, and Sandy Beach was speaking at the South Bay Roundup. And the night before the Roundup started, they had him speaking at a local meeting. Sandy couldn't make it to the meeting. I get a phone call. Can you speak at this meeting tonight? I don't know that Sandy is expected at that meeting. And I walk into that meeting, and I would like to tell you in the spirit of Alcoholics Anonymous, everybody was like, oh, okay, Ralph is here. People were like, where's Sandy? Where the hell is Sandy? Ooh, my people, thank you for the welcome. You know, so somebody might be sitting out there tonight. That dude doesn't look like Clancy, you know. If you close your eyes real tight and squint real hard. And maybe I'll spin some yarns and mess up some names, and then you'll think, oh, that is Clancy up there. I think I'm supposed to talk about the gift of a lifetime. And I got here this afternoon, and so I see it's following a theme. We had someone speak, and I wish I had heard her, Lily, talk about the gift of laughter, because I didn't get to hear her talk, but I got to have dinner with her. I got the Cliff Notes version. Oh, my God, talk about the gift of laughter. You know, I wish I had been here. Then we had the gift of family recovery. Wasn't here yet for that one either, but I happen to know the family. And so I happen to have heard each one of those individuals before, and so I know that at least the conference was gifted with the gift of family recovery. And that's kind of a special place in my heart, too, because I got family. And so tonight, the gift of a lifetime, kind of appropriate. I don't know if we'll be here that long because I don't know how long I can make it. If I pass out, somebody up here, Leslie, will give me mouth to mouth, so I'm cool. But let's see how long we make it. I'm reading a book now. I don't know if I should be reading it. because this book is going to be a book that kind of uncovers and brings the curtains back on some stuff that I've been raised with, right? And there's a brand new book out by Bill Sharman, and it's a book called The Writing of the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous, The Making of the Writings of the Big Book Alcoholics. Really fascinating, and I'm a history guy, right? I'm really interested in our roots. I'm really interested in where we come from. I'm really interested in what has us here in this room this evening. And so, you know, I'm a guy that studies stuff like that. I hesitate to talk about it in a room like this because it's probably people in here who are much more, you know, conversant with the history than I am, you know, but if you're new with us this evening, we trace our roots, we go back, you know, and we go as far back as, you know, for most of us, you can probably take us back to Washington, but for most of us, there was a guy who had a drinking problem. Similar to me, I would guess, in the sense he had a drinking problem. Dissimilar to me in every other respect. Dude had a lot of money, came from a rich family, had a wealthy background, you know, and Sky Roland Hazard, late 20s. And Roland, because he had a drinking problem and he had money, he could do what people with money did. He could throw money at his drinking problem, right? Family sent Roland off to meet with Dr. Young, Carl Young, the preeminent, you know, shrink of the day. You had Freud, you had Young, and thank God it was Young that he went to see. And he went to see Dr. Young, stayed with Young for about a year. Young did what it is that he does, you know, shrunk him real well, you know. Roland said he was sure at the end of that year he understood the inner workings of his mind, you know, probably spanked his inner child, got in touch with all that, you know, knew all his triggers, you know, and all that at the end of a year. And so he left Young. Young says, go forth, young man, you know. And so Roland leaves Young, you know, to live happily ever after. Didn't get back across the water. Roland was drunk. Did what it is I would do if I spent good money like that for about a year with a dude who was certified, not a quack, not a guy that you see on TV advertising. No, this is Dr. Carl Young, preeminent guy. Dude, so Roland shows back up to Young, right? Dude, I spent good money with you. Talk to me. What happened? I thought that you were going to take care of me. I thought that my problem would be cured. I thought that this alcohol, you know, this thirst I have, you know, I would be. What happened? Talk to me. And Young looked at Roland and Young said, look, dude, I tripped. I gave you the wrong diagnosis. I misdiagnosed your case. You present like a lot of other folk. You present like manic depressive. You present like bipolar. You present like schizophrenic. But what you really are, you have the mind of a chronic alcoholic. And I have not seen a single case like yours that I know of where the methods I have employed have been successful. What? You wait till I spend all my money to tell me that? Wait. Hold on, doctor. Is there anything you can do? It ain't nothing I can do for you. And really, it ain't nothing I can do for you. I've never seen a case like yours as advanced as yours. I've never seen a single case recover. I done spent all my money. Come on, man. Tell me something. Okay. Every now and then, here and there, I have heard about, I haven't personally seen them, I've heard about what we call these vital spiritual experiences. You know, these transformations. They seem to be in the nature, he calls them huge displacements, you know. And he talks to himself, he said, but I ain't been able to affect one of those. I know about them. I've heard about them, you know. Some people that I know, I've heard some talk about, I've not been able to do it. The only suggestion I can give you is if you're part of any religious organization, if you're part of any religious body, you know, go back to your people and hope you get struck by lightning. Because you got as much chance of getting sober as you have of getting struck by lightning. Roland is like, damn. You know, so he left and he traveled back home, part of an Oxford group, and he went back to the Oxford group. And Roland Hazard went back to the Oxford group, and Roland got struck by lightning. Something happened in the Oxford group. And Roland was able to undergo this vital spiritual experience, this transformative experience. And Roland, while he was in the Oxford group, you know, one of his childhood buddies came, right? And in the Oxford group, they had some practices that you had to do. One of them was witnessing, one of them was getting guidance, you know. And when they were in this Oxford group, they would look for people. And he heard about his buddy being brought in front of a judge for a case, Abby Thatcher. Evie was crazy. And so he was being brought up on charges, and Roland had a buddy whose father was the judge hearing Evie's case. Roland and a couple of his boys showed up at the case. And they said, ask Pops, look, can you release him to our care? Did that. Evie Thatcher became part of the Oxford group. Something happened to Evie. And when it became time for Evie to go out and witness in his 60-day period, he thought about, who could I go talk to? And he thought about a buddy of his, Bill Wilson. And we all know the story. And Abby Thatcher went and met with Bill Wilson. And Bill Wilson, shortly after his meeting with Abby Thatcher, had a white light experience, not too long from now. December of 1934, Bill Wilson found himself in Towns Hospital for about the third or fourth time that same year, had been in that same hospital. The previous time to coming to that hospital, he had got what amounted to a death sentence from Dr. Silkworth. Dr. Silkworth had told Bill's wife, look, get a black dress. Dude is liable not to leave here again. And if he leaves, he'll probably have a wet brain or have to be permanently locked up. So when Bill went back this last time, he was already primed for that. In a severe depression. He had drank in November of 1934. He had seen Abby Thatcher. Abby had planted a seed with him. He had seen somebody sober. So when he went in Towns Hospital this time, he was defeated. I know I'm not coming out of here. I heard what the doctor said last time. In the depths of that kind of despair, something happened in December of 1934 in Towns Hospital. And it happened to him so dramatically and so suddenly, Bill later called it a white light experience. And it happened to him, and it scared him. It scared him when it happened to him. Because he had remembered when Dr. Silkworth had told his old lady, dude is close to going crazy. He was wondering, am I losing my mind? I'm glad it happened to Bill Wilson and it didn't happen to me. If something like that had happened to me, I probably would have thought, oh, it's one of them PCP flashbacks. It wouldn't even be no Alcoholics Anonymous. Wouldn't be none of this, you know. But it happened to the right man at the right time in the right hospital with the right doctor. And he recounted what happened to him to the doctor. Check this out. This is what's so remarkable about this story. It's a couple of remarkable things about it. But what was so remarkable, we'll recount it to Dr. Silkworth. Dr. Silkworth wasn't even in the room at the time this event happened. But apparently whatever was on Bill was so remarkable that Dr. Silkworth, from the outside looking in, when Bill recounted what happened to him, Dr. Silkworth didn't scoff, he didn't trip, he didn't say, oh man, you crazy. He said, you would look good holding on to it. I don't know what happened to you, but you'd look good holding on to it. And Bill Wilson set about looking for people like me and you. And in about 6 months' time, he was out preaching to people. You got to have this experience I had, you know, trying to get everybody sober. It's been estimated, you know, I've heard people estimate he talked up to upwards of 40 people. I heard somebody estimate upwards of 96 people. I don't know. But he was out talking to drunks. And there, man, go. You messing up my high. Go. Ain't nobody trying to stay sober, right? And in that period of time, some people we did business with put together a business opportunity. They said, we'd like you to represent our business interests in Akron, Ohio in this proxy fight. And if you handle this business and if this business comes off all right, you'll be president of the company. And he traveled down to Akron, Ohio that May of 1935. And his business did not come off too well. And he found himself in a hotel lobby. Day before Mother's Day. And in that hotel lobby, he got thirsty. Could see the bar from where he was standing in the lobby. Could hear the ice clinking in the glasses. And he had a thought, strange thought. He said, I need to find a drunk not to drink. He had been looking for drunks for 6 months so they didn't drink. He had a thought standing in that lobby, I need to find a drunk so I don't drink. Significant. That's what it is we do. And through a series of divine coincidences, he got put in touch with a lady who had a husband like us. And Henrietta Cyberling put him in touch with Ann Smith, and he called, and he, I understand you got a husband with a drinking problem. Dr. Bob was passed out, woke up long enough to tell his wife, tell dude I'll give him 15 minutes tomorrow. And they met the next day. And that 15 minutes turned into 5.5 hours. And those two gentlemen set about looking for people like me and you. Imagine that. Height of the Depression, May of 1935, June of 1935. Two men. And in 2 years' time, they had found about 40 people staying sober. Talk about the gift of a lifetime. About 2 years' time, they had found about 40 people staying sober. 40 people between Akron, Cleveland, and New York. And I like to think the New York hustler must have looked at the Akron physician and said, how are we going to let Ralph White know when it's his time? And they said, we'll put it in a book. They had three ideas. They had what they called a counting noses meeting. It's what is commonly referred to now. And Bill and Bob, they sat around and they counted and they called it substantial sobriety time. There are lots of myths that grow up about that time in our history. And people will be thinking it was a lot of successes early. It was a lot of failures, a lot of heartbreaks, a lot of going out and beating the bushes, you know. But in 2 years' time, it found about 40 people. They said, wait a minute, it's a whole lot of drunks out there needing to get this message. If we go in at 40 people every 2 years, we're going to have a hard way to go. How are we going to let them know in Los Angeles? How are we going to let them know in Dallas? How are we going to let them know in Pensacola? You know, how are we going to let them know in New Jersey? How are we going to let them know in Tennessee? How are we going to let them know? They said, we're going to do it. And they had three ideas, a chain of hospitals, paid missionaries, and a book. In a book. Now, if we get this chain of hospitals and if we get these paid missionaries, those are all going to require some money. So what's the easiest way to get the money first? Let's write a book. Started writing that book. 1938. Published that book in April of 1939. I hit this earth sometime after that and I hit you guys sometime after that, and it blows me away that they put me in that book. And throughout the course of this weekend, we'll have some people to come up that'll talk about not only the impact that book has made on their lives, because the book is cool. I like that Sandy used to say, the book is not the, you know, the book is not the treasure, it's the map. More importantly, you'll have some people this weekend talk about the impact of the power that's found in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I like to think on October 11th, 1986, I was my own personal. You know how when you got these weather fronts that come in, it's some Floridians here. You guys get them sometime too, hurricane season. You can see them coming. You can see them coming. Meteorologists can tell you they're coming, but can't stop them, can't do nothing about it. They can see it. They can predict it. They can see it coming. But can't do nothing but say evacuate, get out the way. In October of 1986, a tsunami like that was raging through my life. It had been like that for a minute, washing me away, slowly but surely, just beating down on me, beating down on me, beating down on me. And on October 11th of 1986, it seemed like the wave stopped right here. Stopped right there. And everybody in this room that's got a sobriety date got a wave stopping date. That it stopped right there. I hadn't took a step. I hadn't read a book. I hadn't got a sponsor. I hadn't gone to a meeting. Stop right there. What is that? What stops that? Most of our members call that grace. And we don't produce the grace. We can't predict the grace. We don't control the grace. we access the grace. And I've spent the rest of the time since October 11th, 1986, expanding on the grace, growing the grace. And I get grateful. When Dick asked me to talk about the gift of a lifetime, see, I'm a kid that grew up with dreams, goals, hopes, and ambitions. Kid who come from nothing. I come from Watts. Growing up in the 60s, mom on welfare, single mom, alcoholic dad, put out, raising six boys, you know. Dreams, goals, hopes, and ambitions. I hear people share a lot of times at podiums, and a lot of times we'll get confused and we'll think it's the circumstance that makes me alcoholic. It don't make me alcoholic. Circumstance. I'm not alcoholic because I'm a product of a broken home. Somebody in here grew up with both parents. I'm not alcoholic because my daddy was one. Somebody in here grew up with parents that never drank. I'm not alcoholic because I'm a poor kid from the ghetto. Look around the room. You know that ain't the reason. I'm not alcoholic because I'm a little guy. I see plenty of big guys up in this room right now. I'm not alcoholic because we didn't have no money. Somebody in here grew up with a silver spoon. I'm alcoholic for two reasons and two reasons only. One, when I take one, I can't tell you when I'm going to stop. Two, when I sincerely don't want to put it in me and start it up again, I put it in me and start it up again anyway. I'm bodily and mentally different. That's it. That's all. You know, so I'm the kind of kid that on the outside, some of my outside circumstances might have dictated this kid is going to grow. Mm-mm. Wouldn't have traded the way I grew up for nothing in the world. You know, got a mom that's the most remarkable lady I know to this day. Grew up high achieving, class president, student body president, straight A student, teacher's pet, all stars, you know, dreams, goals, hopes, and ambitions. I had two goals when I was a kid. My first goal was to wear number 30 and play shortstop for the Dodgers. Baseball was my game. Got to high school, never got over fear of the ball. You ain't going to play baseball if you don't get over fear of the ball. You just ain't going to play baseball. One of the best kids on the team, I was playing Little League, and Sylvester, you know, this lefty was playing, and he was wild. And he plunked him up here, and Sylvester started crying. And that's the kid I looked up to. I'm like, phew. You know, and I'm fast, I'm quick, I can play defense, but never got over the fear of the ball. So gave that up. And my second goal, said it with everything in me. I said, I'm going to be the first black president of the United States. Thank God where I come from and in my neighborhood, people didn't titter at that. People encouraged me because I'm a high achiever. I'm that guy growing up in the 60s, changing time, turbulent time. You know, a lot of changes going on in this country, and I was going to be somebody and I was going to make a difference in my name. So I'm that guy. I'm growing up like that. First kid off my block to go to college, near my brother Ron, near my brother Reggie. Everybody knew the white boys on my block. My last name is White. So everybody knew the white boys on the block, you know. Really, you know, everybody knew. High achievers, making mom proud, write-ups in the paper, all the rest of that. You know, and it seemed like not that long later, everybody on that same block knew the white boys again because Neighborhood Watch was like, you got to get rid of these boys. You know, it seemed like when you get into life, it just happens. You know, I don't know when that happened. You know, so I'm a late bloomer. You know, I'm late to the game of alcoholism. You know, I started drinking when I was 16 years old, and it really didn't count for me. It really took off for me when I went to college. And I went to college, and I started, you know, I was majoring in drinking, minoring in Bid West. You know, you don't live in the dorms at UCLA and not drink and smoke weed and play Bid West. That came with the territory, you know, and but I got this thing. It distinguishes me from my fellows. I got this thing. A couple of years ago, I went to the hospital. I was leaving Atlanta, going home, and I was on a flight, and I passed out on the flight. Bam. Oh, passed out. And it turns out I was dehydrated, hadn't had enough hydration, and blah, 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 a lot of stuff. But, they were really concerned. My daughters rushed me to emergency when I got home. They did a full battery of tests. Now, they had this test that they could do, and it showed that I was pre-diabetic. And there were some numbers. There was a number range that you needed to be inside of. And I was at about 158. If you got to 165 or 166, you're diabetic. So, and they told me some things I needed to do dietary-wise and the rest of that, you know. And so there were some things you could look at. But when I was 16 years old and I started drinking that rum and coke, if you had taken me down to Kaiser Hospital and if you had x-rayed me, CT'd me, MRI'd me, did everything else, there's nothing that says he's got that thing. There's no test that says he's bodily and mentally different. There's nothing we can look at. I look just like the people sitting around me. These older guys, these older partners of mine that first put me down in the drinking game. You know, I was at this school. These guys were playing football. We were going to watch them on Sundays. We were going to watch them in the association during the week. They were going to be business leaders in my town, in this state, and in this country. You know, those same guys, when we left school, they start getting married, having families, raising, you know, getting in business, doing what. But I got that thing. I have that thing. And the party's never over for me. So I started losing late. I think that's kind of a good thing. I think that's kind of a good thing. Because I got married, had a child, ended up doing like my daddy, got put out of my house. My five brothers ended up getting put out of their houses. All of us started when we were grown. And we ended up in my mom's house, all six of us. And we damn near killed her. And I think the saving grace, because I listen to a lot of you guys' stories. I listen to a lot of you guys' stories. And as kids, you were already down this road. A lot of our members have stories like that. As kids, it already been heartbreaking. As kids, it already been in the system. But I had my mom. My mom was so accustomed to these high-achieving boys that it took a while for her to give up. It took a while for her to give up. And that's the grace. So I get put out of my house and I went to stay at my mom's house. My daughter's 2.5 years old. I'm taking money out of her piggy bank before I got put out. And on October the 11th of 1986, something happened. I think when desperation meets opportunity, there's a window of grace that opens up. And that window opened that time, and I jumped through. And I started coming to meetings with you guys. My brother Ron was already a member of this fellowship. You know, when you go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and if we have anybody that's new, there's a rhythm. There's a rhythm in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a rhythm to the meetings, and there's a rhythm to the sharing. I know you hear some people say there are no bad speakers in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's probably true, but you got bad listeners. I'm one of the bad listeners. So every now and then somebody will be up at the podium. I'll be like, what the hell is he talking about? And then that'll be the main person that in the line, somebody in front of me will be like, you told my story. I'll be like, don't be encouraging him. You know, right? I got a friend that tells a story. He was sitting at a meeting with his sponsee brothers. And they made the mistake of sitting at the meeting by their sponsor, sitting near their sponsor. And one of the sponsee brothers was listening to the speaker, and he's like, man, that dude's not talking about nothing. I'm not getting nothing. And Sponce looked at him and said, maybe he's not talking to you. Wow. There's somebody else at the meeting? Wow. What a concept. I look at going to meetings, you know, and now I'm gonna just go off the road. I look at going to meetings kind of like going to a concert, but it's different than a concert, because at concerts, you don't mix up genres. You're not going to have Snoop Dogg over here and Billy Ray Cyrus. You're not going to have that. You know, you're going to have rappers, or you're going to have country, or you're going to have R&B. But at a meeting, you get into everything. You know, so for me, to make it easy for me, sometimes a guy gets up here and he's going, I'm like, oh, that's rap. And I'm like, okay. And it'd be some people, you know, they like that, and I'm like, okay, that's right. And then somebody else gets up, I say, oh, that's country western. And some other people in the group are like, oh, okay. And then there's somebody up there, I'll be, ooh, that's opera. And a couple of people are like, okay, doing it, you know. Then there's somebody up there, and I'm like, yeah, and you know, I'm like, yeah, yeah, that's R&B. Okay, that's R&B. And then you get those transcendent ones, you know, like Streisand, Michael Jackson, and everybody's kind of grooving. So I kind of look at meetings somewhat like that. You know, to me, there are kind of two kinds of speakers at a meeting. It's way more than two, but for me, it's kind of like two kinds. I call them, you know, one of the speakers, I call them head speakers, and I'm okay with that because I'm a head guy, I'm an analyst guy, you know, but a head speaker, every now and then, it feels too much like finger in your face. Get your finger on my face. I'm not trying, you know, stop, you know, you know, instructing me. But then you have the other kind of speaker. At my first home group in 9604 South Figueroa, that was my first home group. And we had a brother named Brother at that home group. And Brother used to say, when heart speaks, heart hears. And that's the ones that most people really resonate with. Because in here we speak the language of the heart. And I guess I went the long way around the block to say most of the time that's where I go. So a lot of times I don't know where what I'm here. I hear it when you guys hear it. If I'm telling my regular story, the first piece, I know about it. And that's the rhythm. That's the rhythm in listening to speakers if you go to a lot of speaker meetings. And there is a rhythm to it, because most of the time when people, there are two places that are instructive in the book to talk about when we speak. So most of us know our stories disclosed in a general way, what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And then there's another part in the book, and it talks about each one of us in our own language and from our own point of view will share about how I formed this relationship with the power. And I frame that, how I formed this relationship with it. Usually I frame it through what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And when I do that, there's the rhythm to that kind of story, because the rhythm is first, you know, okay, the front end of the story, it's all over the place. We don't know. It might be happy. It might be happy-go-lucky. It might be really brutal. It might be, you know, some tragic stuff on the front end. All of us have different circumstance that brings us to where we are in our life. So that's the front end, the circumstance. Then almost all of us hit the chorus. Bam. Thrill is gone. You know, and then, you know, you hit the circumstance, then you do the flying, and then thrill is gone. And that one lasts longer for others than it does for some. Sometimes it'd be like, oh, man, you know, again, then it drops lower and lower. And then you hit the pivot point. It's the sweet spot. It's still the spot that gets me. You talk about then I had a knock on the door. Maybe the police. Maybe my brother. Maybe a boss saying we don't want to see you here no more. Maybe the wife, in my case, putting the stuff on the front porch. I remember many of you guys, what happened. When I hear Joe's what happened, it makes me cry. I don't even want to recount Dick's. He's got a couple. One of them is a little too risque for me to go into right now. But I love him in the tuxedo with the Black Panthers in the jail cell. I love him. And then I hear the what happened. And then you say something that gets me every time. You say something that gets me every time. You say, then I walked into my first meeting at Alcoholics Anonymous. Polly says, I was 12 steps from a jail cell in Euless, Texas. from a motel room in Euless, Texas. Polly ain't never been to jail. She's too, motel room in Euless, Texas. I know your stories. That's the sweet spot. I'm a sucker for a happy ending. I know it's getting ready to get to the good part right now. And inside the good part is some low spots. Inside the good part is some stumbling. Inside the good part, some physical challenges. Inside the good part is some BKs. Inside the good part is some losing houses. But goddamn it, we stand. You talk about the gift of a life. We stand. I didn't know that's what I was signing up for when I came in here and I signed up with this outfit. I report for duty every single morning. When I got on my knees with a group of men and women, somewhere in a year and a half sober, I got on my knees with a group of men and women. And I got in the game. I said, God, I offer myself to you. Do something with your boy. Remarkably, I had a man in my life, and it wasn't my dad. I had a granddad. Used to talk about that man all the time. Blue collar guy. Married to my grandmother 56 years. Granddaddy was home every day at 3:30. Me and my brothers, I used to look at him, especially when I was a young adult and I was a young man. I used to say, who would want to be with the same woman 56 years? And I love my grandmother. Love my grandmother. Love my granddad. But the idea of that kind of routine, dull, sting, you know, that kind of, you know. Granddaddy was at church every Sunday morning. When I turned 16, I said, you'll never have to worry about Ralph White darkening the doors of nobody else's church. Said it, did it, meant it. Yeah, granddaddy, you need to be in here. You need somebody telling you how to live your life. You from another generation. You ain't slick like me. You ain't cool like me. You don't know what time it is. I make more money in a year than you made in your whole career. Blah, 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 blah. And you know. But I made it to you in October 1986. In November of 1987, I started going through the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous with a group of men and women. And we hit the chapter, We Agnostics. And my life was tore up. And I remember reading in that chapter, be quick to see where religious people are right. They have been exhibiting a degree of stability, usefulness, and happiness that you should have been looking for yourself. LO63992. Some old folk in here that remember when phone numbers had letter prefixes. LO63992. That's my grandparents' phone number. Both of them been dead for a long time. They had one phone number my whole life. I don't even know how many cell phone numbers I've had. They had one phone number their entire life. 1726 East 107th Street. They had one address my whole life. And I used to scoff at my granddaddy. And I used to talk crazy about my granddad. And I used to look at him. And it dawned on me when I was reading chapter We Agnostics. Granddaddy never asked you for bail money. And you guys, you know they say that this program is, you know what I've gotten from this program? I've heard a lot of people share it. When I was new, they used to share it a lot more. Beyond your wildest drunken dreams. And I can't say that's part of my story. I had wild drunk dreams. I had wild sober dreams. I had dreams of being a millionaire before I was 30. Ain't gonna happen. I'm 66. Still ain't gonna happen. I had dreams of living a certain lifestyle. I had even had some dreams about certain career. Not bad stuff either. So for me, it's not beyond my wildest drunken dreams. What has happened for me in Alcoholics Anonymous? You've given me dreams. You've given me dreams I didn't even know I wanted to have. I didn't know. I didn't know what it would feel like to have these two little boys. I got a 11-month-old grandson and a 6-year-old grandson. I inherited 5 grandkids when my wife got married. My wife got married. When my daughter got married. See, maybe that's a sign. It's time to sit down. You know, you punchy. When my daughter got married, I inherited grandkids. And I'm granddaddy. And I'm not granddaddy entitled. I'm granddaddy like I used to look at my granddaddy. Got a 24-year-old daughter and a 36-year-old daughter. The daddy's girls. I don't even know what I did. I don't even know what I did. Sometimes I look at my life and I think to myself, dude, you didn't know when you were signing up for this duty what you were really signing up for. You think you know. You think you know. We got a part in the book when we talk about amends. We talk about the alcoholic. It's like a tornado running through the lives of, a blameless, unblameless, wise, and the rest of that. But check this out. Just like everybody whose life I touched when I was out there, I'm touching lives when I'm in here. You don't even know. Every time we go to a meeting, it's somebody's life getting touched. It's somebody else's life getting transformed. Just as a result of me sitting in here at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Talk about the gift of a lifetime. And when I was in the Harbor Light Center, I'm going to get ready to get out because I know I'm getting punchy. But when I was in the Harbor Light Center in October of 86, my daughter was 2.5. It was October when I went in. So Christmas came when I was coming up a little over 60 days. I had money on the books. And I went and got $60 that Christmas, before Christmas, to go Christmas shopping for my little girl. Now, I'm a ostentatious, I'm an extravagant guy. Leslie, you know, we have big Christmases at Dwight. Me and all my brothers are sober now. We have family is hugely important to us. You know, it's big, 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 big. But that October in 86, I went downtown in downtown Los Angeles, and I bought a little pink jacket with a gray fur collar. Cost about $40. And I look back on it, and it looked like a $40 jacket in my mind's eye right now. But when I bought that jacket back then, that December in 86, it looked like a mink stole. It had been a long time since Daddy was coming back. Following Christmas, I was sober a year. My brother Ron was sober a year. My brother Reggie was sober about 9 months. And my brother Rob was still out there. And he was on Skid Row, and he called home and he asked, "Can I come home for Christmas?" On Christmas Eve. And I went and picked him up. When he got in the car, I didn't recognize him. My brother Rod is the baby, pretty boy, mirror, preening all the time. I drove around looking for him, didn't recognize him, caked in dirt. Got him to the house. My grandmother was still alive at the time. My mom said, "Don't let my mama see him." and we hustled him in the house and put him in the tub. If you hear Rod share his story, he shares that's the best Christmas he ever had. And December 25th of 87, my fourth brother came into the program of recovery. And this gift of ours, I feel especially blessed. And I hope you do too. But I feel especially blessed. Last week, my mom, who had a nervous breakdown when she was 85 years old. No, scratch that. In 1985, my mom had a nervous breakdown. My mom was 55 years old then. And we almost lost her. And we started coming to you guys in 1986. And last Saturday, we sailed back into port at the culmination of a Caribbean cruise with my 89-year-old mom with all her boys. You couldn't have told me. I don't have scientific evidence. I don't have a way to prove it. But when my mom was 55 years old, she damn near died of a nervous breakdown because she had six sons in the life. The four who needed to started coming to you guys in 1986. And we took my 89-year-old mom cruising. I didn't come here for the ripples, but I stayed for the ripples. I didn't know that every time you see me standing up here, I'm not standing up here by myself. And you're not sitting out there by yourself. Every time I go to a meeting, me and you, we get the opportunity, doing it right now. I get to participate in some little boy or some little girl getting ready to have mama come back. Every time I go to a meeting, me and you, we're doing it right now. Get to participate in some family getting ready to have daddy come home. Every time I go to a meeting, me and you, we're doing it right now. Get to participate in some man or some woman I could care less about and don't know getting ready to have a hell of a mate in their life. Every time I go to a meeting, me and you, we're doing it right now. Get to participate in some employer that I don't know and could care less about. Getting ready to have a hell of a employee enter the workplace. Every time I go to a meeting. In this season in particular, it's a whole lot of Christmases that are different. Because me and you sit in rooms like this. The gift of a lifetime. I don't take it for granted. You never hear Ralph White say, I don't know why I'm sober. I know exactly why I'm sober. I get a blessing so that I can be a blessing. Recovery for me is a gift from God. What I do with my recovery, my gift to God. My name is Ralph White. I am an alcoholic.